faster. When a piece breaks or gets waterlogged from a leaking roof, GSA artists make repairs so that you can't tell it was ever damaged. The White House is that kind of place, immaculate. But by far the most important reality at the White House is the people. As an FBI agent, my job was to help maintain the high quality of White House personnel. Each administration has hundreds of political appointees. But in terms of numbers, they are far fewer than the permanent staff who work from one presidency to the next. The political appointees filled vacancies ranging from support slots that paid about $25,000 to start to special assistants to the president who made more than $100,000. They could keep those jobs as long as their candidate held office. But many of the permanent staff could expect to work at the White House for 20 years or more. The permanent staff could, however, be fired or transferred if they did not measure up, and they were investigated every 5 years by the FBI to ensure their continuing good character. Other non-political employees were detailees from an agency that loaned them to the White House. Some had 1 or 2 year assignments. Others had open-ended terms and could stay as long as they wanted, or until some high-level political appointee got angry with them. Everyone knew that coming to the White House would mean hard work, long hours, and tough times. Kids' soccer, Cub Scouts, and PTA were all back-burnered. But at the end, one had the reward of having worked there. After all, this was the federal government's equivalent of Mecca. This was the fountain, the source of all power. This was the White House, and to go there was to reach the top. The permanent staff embraced the White House as if it were their home. The GSA gardener trimmed the hedge just so. The flower shop employee placed the roses just right. The file clerk checked twice to see that every file was complete and properly put away. The Marine Guard kept his shoes gleaming. The old guard in their Revolutionary War uniforms played their fife and drums, marching with backs so straight, faces so serious. Working at the White House could be one long celebration of excellence, a continuous 4th of July. One of the finest White House managers was Phil Larson, head of personnel for the OA. But at the end of the first full week of the new Clinton administration, Phil called to say goodbye. He had submitted his resignation to David Watkins, and he was being careful about what he was saying over the phone. Why? Larson would tell me only that he didn't like what was going on, and I'm out of here. Larson's staff on the fourth floor of the NEOB was a pleasure to work with. I often went there to examine his personnel files as part of my FBI spin investigations, and his staff went out of their way to help us track down documents. Larson, who'd been hired by President Carter, was well respected and admired for the diversity he'd brought to his office. And it wasn't diversity for diversity's sake, either. All of his employees had merit and good character. I knew that, because I'd investigated them. Now Larson was leaving. What had happened? Months later, when Congress's investigators, the GAO, stormed the White House to examine the files of the Office of Personnel, I found out. It seems that on 20 January 1993, when hundreds of Clinton people came to work at the White House, many didn't have a job. Hundreds were instructed to come or told, "Okay, come on in. Maybe we'll have something for you to do." They hadn't filled out forms. They hadn't submitted resumes. There wasn't even any proof that they were U.S. citizens. They weren't official U.S. government employees, so they couldn't get paid. It eventually dawned on the Clinton administration that these people had to be given appointments. David Watkins called Larson and told him to draw up the appropriate documents. Larson told him, "Too late. It is illegal to grant appointments retroactively to pay people. We'd have to create phony documents to do that." Watkins didn't care whether it was legal or illegal. He ordered Larson to backdate forms and create whatever documents were necessary, phony or not, so Clinton staff members could get paid. Larson refused, and Larson walked. Watkins immediately reorganized the personnel office, with the result that one of the best-run government offices became one of the worst and least helpful. But there was more fallout from Larson's departure than that. Under Watkins, the Clinton staffers not only got paid, but, according to a GAO investigative report dated 9 September 1993, some of the more enterprising Clinton staffers actually double-dipped. Every new administration is afforded a taxpayer-sponsored transition period, overseen by the GSA. From the election of a president until the inauguration, office space, supporting equipment like phones and computers, and even salaries are furnished to the incoming administration at the taxpayer's expense. Apparently, the Clinton campaign selected 25 staffers to work in the transition office. Later, however, but still during the transition period, these transition staffers also became White House staffers, collecting White House salaries. These 25 had no problem paying their bills, since they were now collecting two taxpayer-financed paychecks. Some were caught by the GAO audit and were forced to pay back the money. But as late as September 1993, 9 months after the inauguration, they were still refusing to reimburse the government and were resisting official notice that they had committed what amounted to a fraud against the government, a federal felony. If a Susie Brown working at the Department of Labor or some other government office had been caught knowingly taking salaries from separate government coffers, she would not only have been fired, she likely would have been subjected to an FBI criminal investigation. But these White House employees who should have been held to the highest standards? The Clinton administration said that it had failed to notice the abuse because the administration was too busy, and the Clinton double-dippers were held to be blameless. David Watkins was the senior manager of the personnel department. If he was too busy to handle personnel matters, just what exactly was he doing? The GAO report also detailed how many new Clinton staffers failed to provide financial reports to the White House counsel's office, as required by law. These staffers would have been the big fish, the ones making $85,000 or more a year. As a result, $200 fines were assessed against each one of them. But did they even know they had to file these reports? Telling them about this federal law was the responsibility of the counsel's office, under the leadership of Bernard Nussbaum, Vince Foster, and Bill Kennedy. Were they too busy as well? Altogether, more than 200 Clinton White House staffers came to work on 20 January, and many worked and worked for weeks, some for months, without any salary, any medical coverage, or any other employee benefits. Nor did they have any legal right to work in the White House, review classified material, or do anything else as government employees. At the beginning of the administration, the White House was inundated by hundreds of uncleared personnel entering as volunteers or health care task force members working on Hillary Clinton's health care plan. Soon, Secret Service ran out of temporary access passes and converted other passes into something that could be hung round the necks of these employees, whoever they were. No requests for investigating their backgrounds had yet been filed with the FBI, and that was a serious problem, based perhaps on a serious misunderstanding. Clinton staffers and volunteers behaved as if they had a right to work in the White House, independent of their being investigated by the FBI and being cleared by the counsel's office and the Secret Service. When the Secret Service tried to screen people as they came through the gates, Clinton staffers often responded angrily, with shouts and insults, as if the Secret Service was there only to harass them, not to protect the president. Given the apparent breakdown in the usual process of clearing employees, I remember asking my partner Dennis whether the Clinton administration was going to retain George Saunders, a retired FBI agent who had been advising the White House on security for 30 years. Well, Dennis said, I spoke to Jane last week, and she didn't know. She doesn't think they even know about George yet, or even what he did for the other administrations. Jane was Jane Dannenhauer, director of the White House Counsel's Office of Security. Jane was the main liaison between the White House and FBI headquarters, and she had been at this work since the Reagan administration. As a political appointee, she would eventually have to leave, but she had agreed to stay on to show the new administration how the security system worked. Jane typified the Reagan and Bush administrations' approach to security. They scrubbed their people before they came to the White House, before they were submitted to the FBI for background checks. Both wanted personnel who were squeaky clean, and if any appointee sneaked through and was later found out to have lied, they'd immediately be handed a cardboard box, told to put their personal belongings in it, ordered to hand over their pass, and then escorted out of the building. But so far, the only people being escorted out of the Clinton White House were would-be attorney generals. Less than a month into the administration, history repeated itself. On 4 February, the president announced that the new attorney general nominee would be Kimba Wood, a federal judge working in a New York district. The very next day, her nomination was withdrawn. It appeared that, like Zoe Baird, Kimba Wood had employed an illegal immigrant as a nanny. Unlike Zoe Baird, Wood and her husband had paid the appropriate employment taxes. But Wood's problems actually went deeper than that. It was later reported that Wood had indulged in a rather un-attorney general-like affair, neatly documented in a diary by her then-lover, New York financier Frank Richardson. Perhaps more worrying for the Clinton administration was that Judge Wood, a former Playboy bunny, might be exposed by Playboy magazine. So, to its credit, and to the Department of Justice's relief, the Clinton administration pulled Wood's name. But how much better it would have been for all involved if the entire episode had been avoided by the simple use of an FBI investigation conducted before Wood was announced. So far, I had handled a grand total of 12 spin investigations involving senior White House staffers, and had probably met and interviewed about 60 or so of the more senior staffers. In the 12 cases I had handled, I realized that the Clintons and their transition team staff were paying even less attention to how they were staffing the White House. In addition, I experienced the new phenomenon of White House employees, that is, the Clinton staff, trying to avoid being interviewed by the FBI. They were not cooperative. My calls were not returned. Appointments finally made were canceled. Or, in some cases, the persons to be interviewed never came to my office, as had been arranged. Some even failed to show up at their own offices at a prearranged time. When I finally located these persons and asked them why they didn't keep their appointments, their excuses were at least consistent. I was too busy to come. Well, why didn't you call or have your secretary call me? The answer would be, I forgot, or I didn't have time, or I did call, and nobody answered your phone. Why didn't you leave a message on the machine? I didn't want to. Why not? I didn't want to. Some enterprising Dodgers did return our calls, but at 10:30 p.m. or at midnight, when they knew full well we wouldn't be there. Their messages would be, I'm returning your call, and that was it. They wouldn't offer any clues as to how, where, or when we might interview them. They were playing a game, but I could think of no good reason to play games with them. They needed me to get their White House clearance, or did they? Had someone told them that clearances were not a problem? Had someone told them, don't sweat the FBI, we've got it covered? There had to be something to explain their lack of concern and cooperation. Dennis was more willing to play cat and mouse than I was. In one case, Dennis was having difficulty interviewing Isabel Tapia, the president's director of advance. Finally, he decided to lurk outside her doorway. When he saw Tapia enter her office, he ran to a phone and called, only to be told she wasn't in. So he waited at the office door, and when she came out, he pounced. Clearly annoyed, she reluctantly allowed the interview. I refused to play those games. Dennis and I made countless complaints and wrote many memos to the FBI about the failure of Clinton staffers to cooperate. When cases started to get behind, our supervisor finally responded, urging us to be aggressive within the bounds of professionalism. In other words, the FBI can't help you guys, but get it done. David Watkins was a good example of what we were up against. Watkins was an FOB, or friend of Bill, a person who had been hand-picked for his job at the White House by the president. He was also a good example of the quality of staff that Bill and Hillary Clinton deemed suitable. Watkins was a long-time close personal friend of the Clintons, and the FBI spin was supposed to establish the good character of Watkins so that he could obtain a security clearance and obtain permanent access to the White House. Before long, Watkins was identified in the mainstream media as a Clinton campaign official who had been accused of sexual harassment in 1992, at about the same time Bill Clinton's alleged affair with Jennifer Flowers surfaced. It was also reported that the victim of the harassment, an accountant from Little Rock, was illegally given $37,000 of campaign funds to keep her mouth shut. The media reported that all parties signed a document crafted by Chris Varney, Clinton's campaign counsel, and also a good friend of the Clintons, affirming that they would keep silent about the incident. Varney was now working in the White House as cabinet secretary, a very high-level position. I approached Varney about the matter, and she told me I shouldn't worry about it. Shouldn't worry about it? That was my job, to worry about serious allegations that involved White House staff. I told Varney I didn't think a legal document signed in Little Rock involving what was clearly a civil matter could or should prevent the FBI from completing a background investigation. Varney disagreed. I called my headquarters and reported the failure of cooperation. I wrote a memorandum about the allegation and the circumstances, along with a request that the FBI spin unit chief, James Bork, call the White House counsel's office and insist that the relevant parties submit to interviews so I could do my job. I waited and waited. Nothing happened. Later, when I asked my immediate supervisor about my request, he told me the case was to be closed without the interviews. The FBI had several options, including a strong request to the White House counsel's office to order persons with knowledge of any allegations against any White House staffer under investigation to submit to interview and provide relevant information. I knew that without such cooperation between the FBI and White House counsel, spins would have little effectiveness, and FBI agents at the White House would have little or no power to obtain the kind of testimony that enables us to do our jobs. Of course, Watkins went on to cause enormous damage to the reputation of the presidency with his ham-fisted, ill-thought-out personnel decisions, including the firing of the travel office staff ordered by Hillary Clinton. Watkins was finally given the boot when he used the president's multi-million-dollar helicopter, Marine One, as a golf cart, and the military crew as caddies. Dennis and I could see all of this kind of collateral damage coming, and that was the reason we were there, to surface the David Watkins types and enable the president the means to deny such troubling persons access before they had a chance to self-destruct. We were powerless to stop it. Other examples of high-level staff with dubious character were all around the White House. A good example is one of President Clinton's closest political friends. He was typical of many of the Clinton crowd. Young or old, man or woman, too many people in the Clinton White House couldn't control their tempers or their tongues. This particular man worked at the White House for almost a year before we were finally allowed to conduct his background investigation. Over the months, I had noticed that this staffer's dress, demeanor, and bearing never rose above the level of unacceptable. He was frequently sloppy, often arrogant, always disagreeable, and had a reputation for being very inconsiderate. Like so many in the Clinton administration, including the president and, sadly, the first lady, this staffer was not able to express his thoughts or make a point without the use of obscene language and rage. The rage was more important to me from an investigative standpoint. There were reports that he had fits of raging fury when crossed, He used violent, coarse language as a sledgehammer to bully people. His office was in the West Wing, not far from the Oval Office, hardly a place to lose it. Because he held a high-level position, it was necessary to interview senior staff, including Mac McLarty. I had already interviewed other senior staff about him. They agreed he had a reputation for using four-letter words and screaming at people, but of course they themselves had never heard any of his tirades. Only one individual thought his behavior was any big deal, and this person was not a member of the Clinton inner circle. The Clinton friends were amused and puzzled that I would be asking about a staffer's obnoxious and rhetorically violent behavior. It was telling to me that they thought this staffer's behavior was normal. I met McLarty in his West Wing office, just doors down from the Oval Office. McLarty was an unusual man. He was highly polished in his manner and dress, but when he opened his mouth, out rolled one of the heaviest Southern accents I had ever heard. McLarty's physical appearance was also unusual. There was a unisex quality to the Clinton staff that set it apart from the Bush administration. It was the shape of their bodies. In the Clinton administration, the broad-shouldered, pants-wearing women and the pear-shaped bowling pin men blurred distinctions between the sexes. I was used to athletic types, physically fit persons who took pride in body image and good health. Arnold Schwarzenegger had called the Clinton friends girly men during the campaign in 1992. I now knew what he was getting at. Mr. McLarty, this particular staffer seems to have an unusual way of expressing his thoughts, and I wonder if I could ask you about that. I'm not sure I understand your meaning, Gary. Well, in the many interviews that I have conducted, there seems to be a common observation and complaint about him. They say he yells and swears at everybody, at staff, on the phone, everybody. And a lot of his screaming is obscene, according to the persons I have interviewed. Can you comment on that? Now, Gary, I can't really see how this is the proper business of the FBI. After all, history tells us that virtually all of the presidents used foul language. Kennedy, Johnson, certainly Nixon, Reagan, and Bush. They have all used, locker room jargon. So I don't see how that is a proper area of inquiry in an FBI investigation. Besides, he's a young man, and it's true that he has some, let's say, rough edges, but he'll mature. We think he's a diamond in the rough. Mr. McLarty, I'm glad you asked me how this might be part of an FBI investigation and why it might matter. Sir, let me first say that I worked for more than 2 years in the Bush White House. It may be true that President Bush swore. I don't know. I never heard him swear, and I never heard anyone claim that he had. In fact, President Bush was known for trying to avoid using coarse language, reverting to gosh and darn and heck and the like. So I can't confirm that President Bush ever used objectionable words here in the White House. I guess it's possible. And, sir, you left out President Carter. I watched for his reaction. There was none, so I continued. Mr. McLarty, there is the issue of loss of emotional control, sir. This man works in close proximity to the president, and he can't seem to moderate his anger. He can't seem to control his emotions. That doesn't necessarily mean he's dangerous, but loss of emotional control, fits of rage, may be warning signs of a bigger problem. Sometimes rage can be attributed to an emotional disturbance, and sometimes rage is an indication of illegal drug use. Cocaine, for example, can cause fits of rage in many people. Do you understand now why I would ask these questions, sir? Well, there is no question of any illegal drug use here. None at all. No, that's not possible. He's just highly emotional, highly excitable. We like those qualities here, you see? Passion, drive, commitment. Those aren't negative qualities to us. They're qualities that define the president. Mr. McLarty, as to the coarseness of language, sir, I'm not talking about President Clinton's behavior. I'm talking about a member of the president's staff, sir. And you see, it's one thing for President Clinton to scream or swear, sir. He's the president, and he can do just about anything he pleases. Everyone knows that. But does that give license to anyone on your staff to act in the same manner? No, 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 I didn't mean that. It's just that I don't see how such behavior impacts on a security clearance. And so what if somebody screams or swears around here? It gets pretty intense sometimes. Sir, I will be happy to answer that question. First of all, this is the White House, and there are a lot of people who think this is a special place that possesses an air of history, tradition, restrained power, and muted emotion. People who work here generally are considered a cut above, a finer lot, if you will, and not taken to screaming and ranting. There is a perception that the White House is made up of persons of proper manners and respect, if not for the White House, then at least respect for their fellow White House co-workers, and respect for the President and the Presidency. This man has several permanent female staff members working near him as support employees, and they are decent people. One I know is very religious. He also has several very young women sitting just outside of his office, and I know they are decent and are probably embarrassed by his behavior. I know that because I know their backgrounds. I conducted their background investigations. By all indications, sir, these women are not motorcycle mamas. I guess what I am trying to say, sir, is that they probably resent being forced to listen to his out-of-control screaming, his explosive temper, his vulgarity, his disrespectful attitude to religion, and his obscene references to biological, scatological, and sexual acts and perversions, all of which seem to be an important part of this man's vocabulary. Sir, I guess I'm asking you if you have received any formal complaints yet, because if you haven't, you probably will soon, sir, since this kind of behavior is lately seen as sexual harassment in most government agencies, most businesses that I am aware of, sir. And this is the White House, where I seriously doubt the standard is expected to be any lower. I don't think that's an issue here. I recommend him without reservation as a promising young man. Is there anything else? Well, I guess that was that. McLarty didn't seem to care much for my passion, drive, commitment to maintain White House standards of civility, if not security. No, sir, I said. As I walked out, I recall thinking, man, this place has fallen so far, so fast. The Clinton crowd justified their behavior by their power, and the limits of their power and behavior were, in their own eyes, non-existent. I returned to my office and waited for a call from headquarters that would instruct me to pack my belongings and leave the White House immediately. But, of course, the call never came. It might have been better for me if it had. Chapter 3. So What? Part 1. Rules for Radicals. The 10th rule of the ethics of means and ends is that you do what you can do with what you have, and clothe it with moral garments. George Washington's rules of civility and decent behavior. Put not off your clothes in the presence of others, nor go out your chamber half-dressed. One morning I went downstairs to check in with my friend Frank Posey, Frank the Framer, and his partner Roland. Frank was an ex-Coast Guard serviceman and trained carpenter, now responsible for framing photos and documents for the White House. As a testimony to his fine work, his walls were lined with personally signed photographs of Reagan, Bush, their chiefs of staff, and other senior officials, ranging from cabinet secretaries to directors of agencies. "There he is, Mr. FBI. Where have you been hiding, my friend?" "Hiya, Frank. Hi, Roland. How are you guys doing? Busy?" "Are we busy? Man, don't ask. Look at this." Frank pointed to a huge stack of unmounted jumbos of the President. I walked over and flipped one right side up so that I could have a look. It was a very good portrait of Bill Clinton. "Do you have to mount all these?" "Yeah, sure. And of course, it all has to be done yesterday, as usual." I asked Frank to save one for the FBI office if he came up with any extras. Frank seemed pleased to be a part of the new administration. If I had to guess, Frank was a Democrat, but he had nothing but praise for Presidents Reagan and Bush. I looked down through the stack. "Where is Al Gore? I don't see any of the Vice President." Frank grinned. He pointed over to another part of his shop, where there was another stack of pictures. "Take a look at those." I walked over and flipped one right side up. But it wasn't Al Gore. It was Hillary Clinton. "Frank, seriously, don't you have any of the vice president?" "Nope, not a one." "These all have to be framed right away, and then we have to hang them, together." In the weeks that followed the inauguration, almost every office received a giant picture of Bill and Hillary Clinton. But in offices that had some connection to Hillary Clinton, there were few, if any, pictures of the president. Al Gore did get some jumbos, but they were restricted almost entirely to the vice president's offices. In all of the administrations that I had been a part of, going back to Nixon, the president's and the vice president's pictures hung side by side in federal buildings and in American embassies. Certainly, some offices with special ties to the First Lady might have a picture or two of her, and in the Bush White House, the East Wing had many pictures of Barbara Bush, because the East Wing was the First Lady's domain. But to have no picture of the vice president sent an obvious message. Al Gore was just a pretty face. As it turned out, Vice President Gore did get the office space usually reserved for the vice president in the White House. The vice president also has possession of three offices on Capitol Hill. One of the offices is located in the Dirksen Building and is rarely used by the vice president. Veep staffers who could not or did not want to work at the White House were often stationed here to deal with matters that overlapped with the vice president's responsibility as president of the Senate. Part of this office space had been made available as a courtesy to the FBI for more than a decade. During the Bush administration, FBI agent Greg Schwartz was so trusted that the staff even gave him his own door key. Gore, however, kicked Schwartz out of the office. I called Greg when I learned he had been evicted. Gore staffers, he told me, had complained that they didn't want to be in the same room with an FBI agent, and that they couldn't imagine sharing office space with a Fed. Why not? Soon, the mystery was solved. It appears that Al and Tipper Gore decided to reward their incredibly hard-working staff after the inauguration by inviting them to a Grateful Dead concert. The Gores were described by a Gore spokesperson as dedicated deadheads. As an FBI agent, I knew the parking lots of Grateful Dead concerts were notorious open-air drug markets, and that the band itself and its followers were an entrenched part of the drug culture. Perhaps I was naive, but given Tipper Gore's history as a critic of offensive rock and roll lyrics, and given the fact that both Bill Clinton and Al Gore posed as moderate New Democrats from the conservative South, I hadn't expected this sort of animosity to the FBI, or this sort of openness to what pundits still call, perhaps over-optimistically, the counterculture. I was disappointed when I discovered that the vice president's staff was not much different than the Clinton staff. They, too, had serious character flaws, which were reflective of counterculture roots, including a casual attitude about the use of illegal drugs. Indeed, many Gore staffers had radical political attitudes. Gore speechwriter Robert Lehrman was one such example. Talking to Lehrman one day, I noticed a book about crime on his shelf. His name was on the jacket as a co-author. Before joining Gore, Lehrman had been a speechwriter for David Bonnier and had also worked for then-Senator Lloyd Benson. Lehrman moved on from Benson's office after writing an explicit novel about teenage sexual experiences. Lehrman told me that the teen novel was really a how-to book for young teens, instructing them in the proper techniques of lovemaking. He was very proud of the book, but it had caused a firestorm of protest among Benson's constituents in Texas, and that had made Lehrman a liability to the senator. I asked him about his book on crime, a subject more up my alley than a how-to sex manual for teens. He loaned it to me with a warning that I might disagree with his findings. I read it with interest and found it hard to imagine how anyone in law enforcement couldn't disagree with his analysis. Lehrman and his co-author had put together a fairly comprehensive history of crime and the various theories of punishment. His conclusions were unusual, to say the least. For example, Lehrman suggested that the crime rate would probably go down if we released all convicted criminals, murderers, rapists, child molesters, from prison. His reasoning? The longer someone is incarcerated, the angrier they become, so that when they get out, they're worse than before. Lehrman's book was a signal to me that the times at the White House were a-changin'. The new White House Director of Security was Craig Livingstone. Craig had no experience in security issues. His only qualifications were that he was a 30-something friend of the Clintons and was built like an overweight bouncer. And his Washington career had opened with a bang. Federal employees were trying to find more than $150,000 worth of equipment lost or stolen from the inauguration, equipment that had been in the charge of Craig Livingstone. Further warning bells had gone off when Associate Counsel William Kennedy had asked me what the FBI thought of Craig's replacing Jane Dannenhauer, and asked me in particular what the FBI would think if there were character issues in his background. I responded gingerly, saying it was a post that should be filled with someone squeaky clean before Kennedy cut me off. I guess I see your point, but it doesn't matter. It's a done deal. Hillary wants him. During one of my first meetings with Craig, he asked me to brief a new class of White House interns. Livingstone confessed his briefing for the first batch had not been serious enough, and that they had had trouble with them. But this time, Livingstone hoped that lectures from the FBI, the Secret Service, and the Metropolitan Police Department would impress the new interns to keep their noses clean. I asked him what sort of trouble he'd had, and he told me that if I repeated what he was about to say, he would know it. The intern problems were a closely held secret, known by only four people: Livingstone, the President, the First Lady, and Mac McLarty. I said, "Okay, fire away. I couldn't wait to hear this." It seemed that when the first group of interns came, they had several problems adjusting to working in the White House. For one thing, they routinely violated the Clintons' dress code. That got my attention. The first serious violation occurred when a well-endowed young lady had trouble keeping her breasts from tumbling out of her blouse. She had become something of a legend around the White House before some female staffers complained about her. But I'd already heard about this one. What else? The second dress code violation was observed by none other than Hillary Rodham Clinton. It seemed that while crossing the West Executive Drive parking area on her way to the OEOB, the First Lady caught sight of a young lady's bare behind. The young lady, wearing a very short skirt and nothing beneath, had bent over. A friend of mine, who must remain anonymous, saw the incident and swears that the young lady turned to the First Lady and smiled. According to Craig Livingstone, Hillary immediately called Mac McLarty and ordered him to ensure that in the future all White House staff wore underwear. McLarty then called Craig and passed the order down to him, confessing that he wasn't sure how one would go about briefing staff members or interns on the necessity of wearing underwear. Craig asked me for suggestions, but I couldn't stop laughing. But there were also more serious problems, Craig said. Hillary had complained that interns and staff members were stalking her. She ordered that Craig ensure that no one looked at her, followed her, or tried to talk to her as she made her rounds. So Craig wanted me to hammer home that interns must remain fully clothed, wear underwear, and not look upon the First Lady. After I stopped laughing, I told Craig that I was not an FBI spokesperson authorized to brief White House interns, but that I was able to talk about spins and employment opportunities at the FBI. He asked me if I could talk about standards at the same time. I told him I thought I could. At my first intern briefing, I was surprised to hear Craig stress in his presentation, which lasted about half an hour, that the interns should have fun. But wasn't that lack of seriousness the problem I was supposed to address? These students weren't at the White House for spring break. They were here to work and earn course credit. My jaw fell when he closed with, "And I know what some of you guys are going to do, but don't get caught. I mean, I'm not asking you to become a narc or anything, but go easy on that kind of thing." He could be talking only about drug use. So, in my own remarks, I warned that what you do can surely come back to haunt you, a message I thought they needed to hear. Each semester until I retired, I participated in the briefing of new interns, maybe 200 or so, who would assemble in room 450 of the OEOB. Room 450 was a theater used mostly by the president. For the better part of a day, the interns would learn about how the White House operated. At my last intern briefing, Craig was clearly tired. His message had changed to "stay out of trouble," period. It seemed that, as director of security, Livingstone was growing old fast. If he didn't watch out, he'd become one of us, a Mormon or a straight, which is what Clinton staffers called FBI agents, the Secret Service, and former Bush employees. Of course, Craig had more problems with his interns than the Bush administration had had with theirs. The Bush and Clinton interns came, obviously, from different pools of applicants. Trouble with the Bush interns was generally limited to using White House stationery for personal letters or making long-distance phone calls. In the Clinton administration, we had a major problem with interns walking off with laptop computers. At least one of these interns was caught by a video surveillance camera. After many denials, he eventually confessed, but only to make a counter-accusation, that he had been set up because he was a member of a minority group. The cultural changes in the political staff of the White House were stark and often depressing for the FBI, the Secret Service, and the permanent staff. One evening, when Dennis was manning the office, GSA supervising carpenter Woody DiGiuseppe stomped in, visibly angry, and said, "Dennis, I'm here to lodge a serious complaint against the Clinton administration." "Woody, as I've told you before, our role here is very limited." "Yeah, I know, but Dennis, I know I trust you, and I don't know about these Clinton people. I'm not even sure of George Saunders anymore. Who does he work for, anyway? If you can't do anything about this, you'll know who to pass it on to, right?" "Well, yes, Woody, I suppose. What is it?" "Look, my guys have to be able to do their work around here, but if the Clinton staff won't let them, then how are they going to do it? I had two guys sent down to the first floor to do some work last night, and they couldn't do the job. Do you know why they couldn't do their job, Dennis?" Woody was shaking with anger. "They couldn't do their job because they walked into a locked office and found two Clinton staffers doing their thing on a desk. That's why." "Woody, Woody, Woody, calm down, my friend. Let's have a reality check here. Yes, I know it's the White House, Woody, but there's been sex here before, and there will be sex in offices here long after we're gone. I don't like it, and you don't like it, and it's disgusting, but it's not an issue for the FBI, unless there is some kind of extramarital affair going on. So, look, Dennis, you don't understand. It was two guys doing it." Dennis told me he had to stop and think for a moment to digest what Woody had just told him. "Are you sure, Woody?" "Yes, I'm sure. These workers of mine are two of my best, my most reliable, and Dennis, they are very religious guys. They're real angry right now, and I don't know what they'll do. What if they go to the press or something? I don't know what to tell them." "Well, look, Woody, let's think before we run off with this. We've never had anything like this before. I still don't think it's an issue for us, not unless there was a security issue involved. Maybe we could get them on misuse of government property. Woody, I suggest you make it a matter of record by getting your guys to write a memorandum. Send it to the GSA front office. Let them deal with it." Dennis had tried to stay cool, but even this FBI veteran was shocked. Later, leaving out the identities of Woody and the men who were offended, he retold the story to a group of permanent staff members. They didn't so much as blink. One of the female staffers said, "Big deal. You think that's something? Last week I went down to the ladies' room on the ground floor. You know, the ones that have the shower stalls for joggers to use? Well, anyway, I walked in the door and heard the shower running, and as I turned the corner I noticed two forms in the shower stall together. They were both women, and they were really going at it. One was standing and the other one was on her knees, and you can guess the rest." "What? This can't be happening," Dennis exclaimed. "This is the White House. Don't these people have any shame?" "No, they don't seem to, Dennis. They saw me come in, but they didn't even break stride." I thought you FBI guys were here to prevent that kind of thing from happening. Aren't you guys doing your jobs? And what happened to the Secret Service? The Clinton staff may have been too busy to talk to the FBI, but they didn't seem particularly diligent in their work habits. I'd often walk into their offices and find the new staffers with their feet on the desk, newspapers spread out in front of them, making personal phone calls, some obviously long distance, on the taxpayer's dime. Staff would gather in the hallways and chat as though they were in a college dorm. I also noticed the hallways were becoming cluttered with boxes, office equipment, and furniture. We were well into the new administration, but they were apparently still in the process of moving in. Melba was our office's GSA cleaning lady. She was almost always cheerful, but for the past several weeks she'd seemed sad or depressed. "Melba, I don't mean to pry, but is there something wrong, something I can help you with?" Melba thought for a moment, and a worried look crossed her face before she blurted, "Mr. Aldrich, sir, no harm intended, but these new people are terrible. Every day we go into their offices and clean up after them, and the very next day it's as if we had never been there before. They're messy people, Mr. Aldrich. These people are sloppy. Some are real slobs, sir. They throw garbage on the floor, or they throw cups of coffee and miss the waste can, and it splashes all over the wall, and they don't clean it up. It's as if they don't care, Mr. Aldrich. And I hate to say this, and you must never repeat this as long as I'm here, but, sir, President Bush's people were much neater and much nicer to us. And that's the God's honest truth, sir. And, Mr. Aldrich, you know that recycle program that President Bush started? Well, the soda cans, plastic coffee cups, white papers, and such are supposed to be separated, put into containers that are marked for each. Then we're supposed to empty them downstairs. Sir, they are throwing everything into one box, or the wrong box, paying no mind to it. And then we have to go through each box and sort their mess out. You would think that these smart people would know how to read instructions plainly written on the side of a box, sir. But I've said too much." Melba looked uneasy, but I reassured her that I wouldn't rat on her to the Clintons. But I did think it was ironic that the supposedly green Clinton administration was not environmentally friendly. It wasn't long before Melba told me she was taking early retirement. She didn't want to go, but she couldn't bear to stay. Watching the White House deteriorate was just too hard. One of the Clinton staffers who might have pushed Melba into early retirement was George Stephanopoulos. Stephanopoulos had taken over the big office that had been used by President Bush's press secretary, Marlon Fitzwater. Clinton's press secretary was Dee Dee Myers, but Dee Dee was stuck over in a small corner office. Why had Dee Dee been relegated to third-class office space? It turned out that the answer was Hillary Clinton. She insisted on having office space in the West Wing and took an office next door to the council's office. This changed the entire West Wing floor plan and led to a series of musical chairs moves. When the music stopped, Dee Dee Myers was out. I had an appointment with Stephanopoulos. He kept me waiting for half an hour. When I was finally allowed into his office, it was a mess. There was a half-eaten sandwich on a paper plate that was on the coffee table. Potato chips littered the rug. Newspapers were strewn all over the room, and work papers had been balled up and thrown around. A birthday cake that had been given to him on 10 February, 9 days ago, was still sitting on an end table. A vase of wilted red roses was nearby. Tired birthday balloons limped along the floor. There were doodads and coffee mugs and what looked like trash sitting in boxes in the middle of the room. I noticed that he had to walk around the boxes to get from the door to his desk. This was day 29 of the administration. Stephanopoulos made no effort to greet me or to be friendly. He was clearly annoyed, which seemed to be the usual mood of Clinton staffers when they met the FBI. It was a hard attitude to swallow, especially after the graciousness of the Bush people. Stephanopoulos looked younger than his 32 years. He had a boyish tilt to his head. His hair was obviously something he was proud of. He must have spent hours each morning in front of a mirror with a brush, a hairdryer, and hairspray, working hard to perfect the fluff and cascade over his forehead. I completed my interview with Stephanopoulos very quickly. I can't tell you what this particular interview was about, but he was knowledgeable about someone who needed to be interviewed. I cannot claim that his answers were deceptive, but they were not terribly informative either. He never uttered one syllable more than he had to in order to cover himself. Before I retired from the White House, I would interview Stephanopoulos several more times. His office never got any neater, though the cake and balloons eventually disappeared. I remember during one press conference early in the administration, Stephanopoulos was seen blowing a big pink bubblegum bubble that ended up hiding half of his face. Bubblegum blown by the director of communications during a presidential press conference. That was one reason the media started talking about the Clinton administration as being a bunch of kids. The Reagan and Bush administrations had had plenty of 20 and 30-something staffers, too, but none of whom behaved like this. It wasn't a matter of age, it was a matter of maturity. I doubt if anyone would rank D.D. Myers as any more mature than Stephanopoulos. I know that in the interviews I had with D.D., I didn't particularly care for her casual and immature attitude, and sometimes neither did the press. One day, when they were bearing down on her, she lost it. Stomping out of the press room, she headed for her office, cursing, "Eat shit and die!" Cursing in the Clinton White House was not unusual. Cursing at the press might sometimes be appropriate, but not if they could quote you. It was the beginning of the end for Dee Dee. For almost a year, she refused to fill out the forms that would allow the FBI to conduct a spin investigation. It became a matter of contention with Craig Livingstone, and he mentioned it in a senior staff meeting attended by Dee Dee and the president. Craig said, "Dee Dee, just how do you plan to answer Dan Rather or Britt Hume when they ask you why you don't have a security clearance?" Dee Dee gave him a flip answer, and President Clinton didn't bat an eye. One day I sat outside Dee Dee's office and watched as she put down the phone and picked up the West Wing mess menu. She knew I'd spent the past 30 minutes sitting there, waiting to interview her per our appointment. But it was amazing how many important matters could come up, like reading the lunch menu, that might interfere with an FBI background investigation. She finally gave me eye contact and motioned for me to come into her office. As usual, she, like so many Clinton staffers, gave me only half of her attention, shuffling some papers or stacking paper clips, which was supposed to be a clear message about how important she thought my visit was. If she thought the interview was nonsense, who could blame her? The president evidently hadn't disabused her of that idea. I dragged as much information as I could out of her. When we were done, Dee Dee relaxed somewhat. "Well," she said, "I guess I'll have to fill out those silly forms one of these days so that you guys can do my investigation." "You haven't filled out the forms yet. Do you have them? Have you been told to fill them out?" "Well, yes, I do. But as you know, we have been so busy around here. These forms are long and complicated. I haven't had the time. I'll get to it, I promise." She grinned somewhat sheepishly. "Look, Miss Myers, I have no power to force you to fill out the forms, but without them, the FBI cannot investigate you. And if we can't investigate you, you won't have a security clearance or a permanent pass. The fact is, people like you make protecting the president and our national security that much harder." "Look, Gary, I said I'd fill out the forms, okay?" I didn't wait around to be told to eat shit and die. I went back to my office, wrote my report, and faxed it to FBI headquarters and my immediate supervisor. Here was a senior White House employee in clear violation of all known security regulations. In her position, Myers was seeing and hearing highly classified, very sensitive information on a daily basis, and yet her background had never been investigated. And she couldn't even claim to be an old Arkansas friend of Bill. Dee Dee was a valley girl from California who had come late to the Clinton machine. The closest thing to a spin investigation Myers had ever experienced was having grown up in the San Fernando Valley next door to an FBI agent. I filed my report, and the FBI ignored it. With the coming of the new administration, Marty Black, a wonderful, polite, calm, and competent executive secretary, was assigned to work for Phil Lader, the Clinton management guru and father of the annual Renaissance Weekend. I needed to interview Lader. After days and days of unreturned phone calls and missed appointments, I complained to Marty and told her that FBI headquarters was her